Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU.
This week, Ed Sheeran wins another song theft legal battle. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. But right now, let's talk about this week, because the biggest event on everyone's calendar is finally here. It's Great Escape Week!
We are in Great Escape Week. It's not Eurovision Week. If anyone's thinking it's Eurovision Week, it's Great Escape Week. And under that, there's a little tiny subset called, oh yeah, the Eurovision's going on. So we just want to clear that up in case anybody's wondering. The Great Escape is here. It's been a busy few weeks for music conferences. I mean, I had a great time at Liverpool Sound City. I had a great time at Spot, which is partly why we skipped another week with the podcast. But let's not dwell on that. Let's dwell on the
and
fact.
We're late this week.
That the Great Escape is here. And the good news is, we're recording an edition of Setlist at the Great Escape, like we did last year, so it shouldn't have that big an impact on our schedule, given how many weeks we've missed of late. I'm not guaranteeing that next week's edition will land on Monday morning in the usual slot, because that will rely on Andy doing the Great Escape, going home, and then editing it, so we might need another day for that. But the point is, as this podcast is going live, The Great Escape is basically upon us. We won't spend too much time running through what's happening, A, because actually we've got two stories to cover this week that are going to take quite a lot of time in themselves, and we don't want a six-hour podcast. But also, if I remember rightly, on the last edition of Setlist, I did go through the three CMU strands in quite some detail. Do you remember that? I'm pretty sure I did.
I do vaguely.
Quick reminder on that: the Wednesday of Great Escape, the CMU strand in the main room at the main conference venue, which is the Leonardo Royal Hotel waterfront right there by the sea in Brighton. On Wednesday, it's music and education, a whole day looking at building bridges between the music industry and music education, the education plan, online learning, music business qualifications, lots of great stuff going on. On the Thursday, it's music and deals, the deals that artists do within the music industry and what they're looking for in terms of support, what they can offer business partners in terms of rights and revenues and reach. And then the future of digital deals and all the latest trends in syncs and samples and interpolations, which will set us up fine for our Friday strand, which is the creator economy. We'll be explaining all the ins and outs of the wider creator economy, but we'll be looking at the music industry's role within it, at the beats and stems and sample marketplaces, the platforms through which musicians now collaborate on making music. We'll throw in a few copyright questions and a little bit of AI into all of that. Plus, what can the music industry learn from online creators, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram creators, about how you go about using different digital platforms and collaborations to build an audience and generate revenue from the fan relationship. Those are the three key strands. In amongst all of that, we've got some fantastic keynote conversations happening just before and just after lunch each day. And on Saturday, it's the Elevate Sessions as part of the Great Escape's professional development program. And it's a whole load of great conversations for those early on in their music careers. That's all the CMU curated stuff happening at the Great Escape in the conference. Then there's the partner program that you should also check out. Panels, workshops, networking, events and parties presented by the Great Escape's industry partners. And then there's the small matter of the festival, with hundreds and hundreds of bands playing across Brighton over the Thursday, Friday and the Saturday. So that's the Great Escape 2023. We will see you there. And assuming you are there, okay, not all of you are going to be there. Some of you don't live in the UK. That's still no excuse. It's an incredibly international event. But maybe you've got a good excuse for not being there. But if you are there, do come and check us out. As I say, in the main room, in the main conference venue, the CMU Strands, it's going to be brilliant. But I went through that super fast because, as I say,
We should probably, before you say your little catchphrase, we should say that if you are coming to the Great Escape, you may have heard the name of the venue back there. We've not moved. The hotel's just changed its name. We're in the same place as last year. So go there.
Yes. If you were wondering where the hell is the Leonardo Royal Waterfront Hotel. For those of you who've not been in Brighton in recent months, it's the exact same hotel we used last year. And in the edition pre the pandemic, it used to be called the Drury's Inn. It's just got a new logo. Other than that, it's exactly the same. But before I was rudely interrupted, albeit with some very important logistical information there from Andy Malt,
yeah,
I cannot stress enough that even though what we're doing in The Great Escape this year is really exciting, and we could fill this entire edition of Setlist just preempting the conversations we're going to have there, it is not, in fact, what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we'll be discussing new proposals for the regulation of the sale of tickets in the US. But first, Ed Sheeran last week won another high-profile, headline-grabbing song theft legal battle, this time one that has been rumbling on since 2016. A jury in New York ruled that Sheeran did not rip off Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On when he wrote his 2014 song Thinking Out Loud. It was not the Marvin Gaye estate that sued, it was the estate of Let's Get It On co-writer Ed Townsend, who reckoned that Thinking Out Loud was sufficiently similar to Let's Get It On to constitute copyright infringement. The Sheeran side argued throughout that there were similarities between the two songs simply because they were created using the same musical building blocks.
Now, as you say, this was something of a headline-grabbing court case, so you've probably already seen quite a bit of this. I mean, you should have been reading about it in the CMU Daily, but it was in all other places as well. But as you probably noticed, Ed Sheeran himself spent quite a lot of time on the witness stand during the trial. For the Townsend side, the Townsend estate, a key piece of evidence for the entire trial was a video that was recorded at an Ed Sheeran show back in 2014, in which the musician himself mashed together Let's Get It On and Thinking Out Loud. And the Townsend estate argued that the video showed two things. Firstly, the similarities between the two songs, and second, that Sheeran was very much aware of those similarities. So important did that video become to this case that actually Ed Sheeran's legal team tried pretty hard, albeit ultimately unsuccessfully, to get the judge overseeing the case to ban the video from being played in court. But they were not successful in doing so. And on the first day of the court case, one of the lawyers working for the Townsend estate, the high-profile civil rights lawyer Ben Crump, dubbed that video the smoking gun in the proceedings, adding that concert video is a confession. But actually, in the end, it didn't do that much to convince the jury of the estate's arguments.
No, and Sheeran himself did quite a good job of responding to the questions about that video. He argued that it's quite easy to combine lots of pop songs in that way, and it's therefore something he does pretty frequently at his shows. He said many songs have similar chords, and as an example, he said you can go from Let It Be to No Woman, No Cry, and no one's arguing that Bob Marley ripped off the Beatles. And then he made a pretty good point, telling the Townsend Estate's lawyer that if I'd done what you're accusing me of, i.e. deliberately ripping off Let's Get It On, then I'd be an idiot to stand up in front of 20,000 people and perform a mashup like that. So it really became a trial about whether or not Ed Sheeran is an idiot or not. I don't know if the jury actually gave a full and final ruling on that. But anyway, Sheeran also spoke about his songwriting generally and also in the case of Thinking Out Loud. And the song, he explained, was written with his friend and collaborator Amy Wodge at his home in England. Wodge started the process by strumming some chords, and along the way, Sheeran started using the phrase, "I'm singing out now." And that then morphed into Thinking Out Loud. And as he went into more detail about his songwriting process, he even picked up his acoustic guitar to play through the beginning of the song while warning his courtroom audience not to get too excited because I'm not the world's most talented guitar player. Also something the jury didn't rule on.
But probably an uncontroversial statement that doesn't need ruling on. Ed Sheeran actually picked up his guitar a few times at the various points in which he was being questioned in court. But we should stress, the trial was not just an Ed Sheeran gig in disguise, because of course there were the customary musicologists on hand to say that the two songs are so similar that one, the later one, definitely infringes the copyright in the earlier one, or not, of course, depending on whether the musicologist in question had been hired by the Sheeran side or by the Townsend estate. Because in cases like this, it's always the case that both sides will present an expert musicologist, and of course, the musicologist for side A will agree with side A, and the musicologist for side B will agree with side B, to the extent that you kind of think they cancel each other out, and you wonder why we even have these expert musicologists on hand, although if it wasn't for cases like this, what would those expert musicologists do, I suppose? Although this time it has to be said, the Sheeran side, both Sheeran himself and his lawyers, were particularly scathing about the musicologist who had been hired by and spoke for the Townsend estate, basically accusing that expert of having misrepresented the similarities between the two songs, and even questioning whether or not he was an expert at all. But in a way, the musicologist bit of this case, not that relevant to the proceedings. I think Sheeran being on the witness stand was what most people were paying attention to.
And like most song theft cases of this kind, the real question for the jury was whether they agreed with the key Sheeran argument that there are some similarities between Let's Get It On and Thinking Out Loud, but that's because both songs used the same musical building blocks. And those short musical building blocks are not protected by copyright in isolation. Ed Sheeran's lawyer, Eileen Farkas, hammered home that point in her closing arguments. She said Ed Townsend did not create these basic musical building blocks. Ed Townsend was not the first songwriter to use and combine these elements. It was not original. And she argued that if the jury did rule in favour of the Townsend side, it would have a negative impact on the art of songwriting as a whole. So she went on, if we start to dissect every song to hunt for similarities and hand out ownership to things as basic as chord progressions and the manner in which they are performed, nothing will be left for songwriters to create. You would be removing an essential element in every songwriter's toolkit. Is that really what we want to do to music? Speaking for the Townsend estate, their lawyer, Keisha Rice, summed up the proceedings by telling the jury that they shouldn't be overwhelmed by Sheeran's commercial success or blinded by his celebrity. She then concluded, "No one here wants to damage creativity. The plaintiffs simply want to discourage theft. That's the difference. We simply believe that credit should be given where credit is due."
Now, I don't know whether the jury were overwhelmed by Sheeran's commercial success or blinded by his celebrity, but bearing in mind it took, what, 7 years almost for this case to get to court, it took the jury just 2.5 hours to decide in the pop star's favour. At one point during his testimony, Ed Sheeran actually threatened to quit music if he lost this case. He then noted that threat had been made when he spoke outside the courtroom after the ruling had been made, saying to the reporters who were surrounding him, "It looks like I'm not going to have to retire from my day job after all." That said, well, clearly he was pleased with the jury's conclusion. He did add, "At the same time, I'm absolutely frustrated that baseless claims like this are allowed to go to court at all. If the jury had decided this matter the other way, we might as well say goodbye to the creative freedom of songwriters."
Of course, Sheeran could have stopped the case from going to court by trying to settle early on, which is what some artists faced with song theft claims choose to do. And indeed, Sheeran himself did that when he was accused of ripping off Matt Cardle's track Amazing on his song Photograph. Although, discussing that claim last year, Sheeran's co-writer on Photograph, Johnny McDade, insisted that it was not settled because we believed that we'd copied Amazing in any way. Rather, he said, following the other big Marvin Gaye song theft case back in 2015 in the US, where it was claimed that Blurred Lines had ripped off Got to Give It Up, it felt like there was a culture, he said, of copyright trials in America which were not going favourably for songwriters at all. However, you do sense that the Sheeran team ultimately decided that while settling song theft claims had short-term benefits and saved Sheeran himself the stress of appearing in court, in the long term it opened him up to even more dubious claims. So in his post-judgment statement, Sheeran said, "I am not and will never allow myself to be a piggy bank for anyone to shake."
And it has to be said, whatever you think of Ed Sheeran and his music, I think it is fair to say that a big portion, I think the majority, maybe even the vast majority of the music making community were with Ed Sheeran on this case and believe that last week's ruling was the right ruling. And in a way, by allowing this case in the New York courts to get all the way to trial, not to mention, you may remember, an entirely different song theft lawsuit here in the UK, which Ed Sheeran and his team allowed to get to the London courts last year, by allowing those cases to go to court, which in both scenarios required Ed Sheeran giving up a chunk of time and going through the stress of being on the witness stand and answering questions, sometimes quite aggressive questions, from the other side's lawyers. By allowing all of that to happen, it does mean we've got a little bit of clarity on both sides of the Atlantic about some of the copyright technicalities which are usually at the heart of disputes like this. In that UK case, which Sheeran won last year, we got confirmation that under UK law, at least, where you have a song theft claim, but the song that has been allegedly ripped off isn't actually that well known, which obviously wasn't the case in this New York dispute, but was the case in the London dispute last year, where that happens, simply having the lesser known track available to stream on Spotify or any other streaming service is not enough in itself to say that the accused song theft had access to the earlier work. So I think that was the key takeaway from the judgment in the Shape of You case in the London courts last year. Meanwhile, here in the New York case around Thinking Out Loud, I think the judgment reaffirms what actually has been a trend in other American courtrooms in recent years. Often these cases end up in the Californian courts rather than the New York courts, but we have started to see, in the wake of that Blurred Lines ruling which went in favour of the Marvin Gaye estate, in most subsequent song theft claims, you're starting to see judges be nervous about the idea of allowing standalone short musical segments that two songs have in common, allowing those musical segments to be protected by copyright in isolation. Judges have become very nervous about suggesting that that is something that copyright should do, for all the reasons that Ed Sheeran's legal team presented in this particular dispute. That said, of course, this was a jury case, because in the US, copyright cases initially usually go before a jury, which would never happen in the UK. And with jury cases, it's always really hard to know which way the jury is going to go. But I think this ruling shows that even juries are of the opinion that where two songs sound similar, but it's because they're using the same chord progressions or the same hook or whatever, it would just be silly to suggest that one song is infringing the copyright of another. Of course, there could be some appeals in this particular dispute. It's not completely resolved as yet. But generally speaking, judges are more cautious on all of this anyway. So if a jury is going to say there isn't a case for copyright infringement here, it seems unlikely that appeal judges would, given that, if anything, judges tend to be more cautious than juries. So by allowing these cases to get to court, Ed Sheeran, aside from, you know, in terms of his own position, making it probably less likely that people are going to sue him in particular with song theft claims, also providing a little bit of clarity on a couple of copyright technicalities on both sides of the Atlantic.
But will that actually stop the flow of song theft claims against Ed Sheeran and other artists? We will see. There is actually another litigation currently going through the motions relating to the same specific claim that Thinking Out Loud infringes Let's Get It On, filed by an entity that has a share in the song copyright of Let's Get It On. And it remains to be seen what impact last week's judgment has on that case. So who knows, maybe in a future edition of Setlist, we'll not just be talking about song theft claims or song theft claims about Ed Sheeran, but the specific claim that Ed Sheeran ripped off Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On when he wrote Thinking Out Loud yet again. But let's hope not. And finally, on this edition of Setlist, the ticketing business remains in the spotlight in America with not one but two sets of proposals for better regulating the sale of tickets put forward in US Congress late last month, and another industry-led campaign launched last week that says it will advocate for a ticketing experience better than the nightmare many fans and artists currently navigate. Now, regular listeners will remember that ticketing became a big talking point in US political circles once again last year after the meltdown that occurred when tickets for Taylor Swift's current tour first went on sale via the verified fan system run by Live Nation's Ticketmaster, prompted By all that, the US Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing in January in which an assortment of issues about ticketing and the live music industry in general were discussed.
Yes, because of course there are an assortment of different issues frequently raised about the ticketing business. Some of those issues specifically relate to the market dominance of the aforementioned Live Nation and Ticketmaster, a market dominance that was created when Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged all the way back in 2010. But other issues relate to primary ticketing in general, not specifically how Ticketmaster works, which includes complaints about the fees that ticketing companies charge and the lack of transparency around how ticket sales work. And then, of course, on top of all of that, there are all the many issues regarding secondary ticketing or ticket touting or ticket scalping, where people resell tickets through unofficial channels. In terms of all those different issues, it's perhaps unsurprising that Live Nation and Ticketmaster would prefer any political focus on ticketing to basically be directed towards resale, to ticket touting, ticket scalping, secondary ticketing. Although it's worth reminding ourselves that in the US, Live Nation and Ticketmaster are still actively involved in secondary ticketing themselves, but for understandable reasons, that side of the business is a side of the business where they are happier for politicians to be investigating and potentially introducing new regulations as they go. Although there is actually one other proposal that would affect primary ticketing as well as secondary ticketing, which generally speaking, Live Nation and Ticketmaster have been supporters of for a while now and of late, which is that there should be a rule that says all ticketing platforms, whether they are the primary official sellers who are selling tickets on behalf of the promoters and the artists, or their touts and scalpers selling on a secondary platform, all of those people should be stating from the off the total price of buying a ticket, including any fees that might then be added as you go through the ticket buying process, rather than advertising tickets in marketing materials and search engine listings and on the first page of a ticketing website without the fees being included, which means you go through the whole ticket buying process and then at the final stage you find out actually there's another $10, $20, $30, sometimes nearly as much as the face value of the ticket added on top for the fees. So everybody should be stating in the advertising, in the search engine listings, on page one of the ticketing platform, what the total price is going to be. Here in the UK, actually, there was a move quite some time ago by the ticketing sector to make sure that happens. But in the US, although a number of ticketing companies, including Live Nation, Ticketmaster, and actually some of the secondary platforms as well, have said that they would support a rule, a law basically, forcing everybody to declare the total cost of a ticket up front. A lot of those companies are saying, we would gladly support a rule forcing everybody to do this, but we don't want to do it on a voluntary basis, i.e. take the lead, because if we suddenly start adding all the extra fees in our advertising materials, etc., but nobody else does, okay, we would get the warm glow of doing the right thing, and maybe we would get a little bit of a PR boost for doing the right thing, but if you've got two companies both selling tickets to the same event and they appear next to each other on a Google search listing, for example, it would look like the tickets from one company were a lot cheaper than the other company because one's declaring the fees and one isn't. So therefore, although companies like Ticketmaster are saying we would support that rule where you have to declare the full price of a ticket from the off, we want it to be a rule that everyone has to go with by law rather than one company doing it voluntarily, so that the companies who choose not to do it on a voluntary system don't get a competitive advantage as a result.
Seeking to steer the ongoing political debate, earlier this year, Live Nation published its own 5-point plan for better regulating the ticketing business. 4 of the 5 points related to secondary ticketing. For example, banning speculative resale where touts advertise tickets for sale that they don't actually have yet, and a ramping up of the existing Bots Act, which prohibits the use of special software to hoover up tickets for in-demand shows from primary ticketing sites. But the final point in that 5-point plan called on lawmakers to mandate all-in pricing nationally. It went on, avoid surprises at checkout and give fans the ability to easily compare prices as they shop by mandating all-in pricing that shows the full out-of-pocket cost of the ticket and fees right up front. One of the proposals unveiled in US Congress last month basically does just that. Its backers are Senators Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell, the latter being the chair of the Senate's Commerce Committee. She said of the proposals, "When families budget for a night at a ball game or to hear their favourite band, they shouldn't have to worry about being surprised by hidden fees that suddenly raise the final cost of tickets well over the advertised price. The price they say should be the price you pay."
Which is a nice snappy line, I guess. Talking of making things snappy, politicians in Washington often like to give their proposals snappy single word names, but then they come up with a longer name that the snappy single word name could stand for. So what is technically speaking a backronym, which inevitably means that the full name of each legislative proposal in Congress ends up being, well, the opposite of snappy. So in terms of these proposals from Cruz and Cantwell, they are calling them, wait for this, the Transparency in Charges for Key Events Ticketing Act. Because then, when you abbreviate it, it ends up being the Ticket Act. So there you go. But beyond the stupid name, what new laws are they actually proposing? Well, if passed, all ticket sellers would be required to display the total ticket price, including all required fees, in any advertising, marketing, or price list for the show. They would also have to communicate the total ticket price and a breakdown of any fees included in that price at the beginning of the ticket buying process on each ticketing platform. And in addition to that, there would be an extra rule which basically would constitute further regulation of ticket resale, in that if a seller is advertising a ticket that they don't yet have, so that's that speculative selling that you were just mentioning, it's not that they're going to outlaw that, but that there will be a transparency thing where the seller would have to declare, "I don't actually have access to this ticket yet, but I'm pretty confident that I can get it for you if you decide to buy it."
Now, given that these proposals basically respond to some of the suggestions made by Live Nation, unsurprisingly, Live Nation has welcomed the Transparency in Charges for Key Events Ticketing Act. Although Cantwell and Cruz don't propose every element of Live Nation's five-point plan, so the Live Giant would obviously like them to go a bit further. A spokesperson for Live Nation said, "We appreciate the good work of Senators Cantwell and Cruz. This bill is a good starting point. We support all-in pricing. However, in order to protect fans and artists, more can and should be done." The spokesperson then basically listed the other aspects of Live Nation's five-point plan not covered by the Cruz and Cantwell proposals. "Those extra rules," they said, "are all common sense reforms supported by a wide array of artists, managers, venues, and countless others involved in live entertainment, and they should be included in whatever reforms Congress considers."
The other proposal put forward in Congress last month came from Senators Amy Klobuchar and Richard Blumenthal. Their proposals have the snappier name, except I don't think you can abbreviate it into a super snappy name. But anyway, it's called the Unlock Ticketing Markets Act. And it would, they said in their statement, help restore competition to live event ticketing markets by empowering the Federal Trade Commission to prevent the use of excessively long, multi-year exclusive contracts that lock out competitors, decrease incentives to innovate new services, and increase costs for fans. So that company that they're alluding to that has 70 to 80% market share, they reckon, of course, they are talking about Live Nation and Ticketmaster.
Now, Klobuchar and Blumenthal have long been critics of the dominance of Live Nation and Ticketmaster. So the fact that they've chosen to focus on this particular element of the wider ticketing debate in the wake of the Taylor Swift ticketing meltdown is no surprise. And announcing the proposals, Klobuchar said, "Right now, one company is leveraging its power to lock venues into exclusive contracts that last up to 10 years, ensuring there is no room for potential competitors to get their foot in the door. Without competition to incentivize better services and fair prices," she added, "we all suffer the consequences. The Unlock Ticketing Markets Act would help consumers, artists, and independent venue operators alike by making sure primary ticketing companies face pressure to innovate and improve." Blumenthal then chipped in, "Consumers deserve protection against the clear excesses and abuses of Ticketmaster, repeatedly demonstrated in their own lives and documented in congressional hearings. This legislation is a step towards basic fairness that everyone deserves, consumers, artists, venues, and others, against a sad and repugnant history of putting its profits above them," he went on. Free and fair markets depend on competition, which is the least that concertgoers, artists and independent venues deserve.
Now, needless to say, Live Nation isn't so excited about the Unlock Ticketing Markets Act, although it did say that because there aren't really any competition issues in the ticketing business, despite what Klobuchar and Blumenthal have said, what the senators are proposing shouldn't really have much impact on Live Nation or Ticketmaster because they reckon they are designed to address issues that don't really exist. So in a statement on that particular set of proposals, Live Nation said, "The ticketing industry is more competitive than ever. Ticketmaster wins business because it offers the best product available for venues, and the length of contracts is generally decided by venues and the guaranteed payments they want to help support their expenses. We do not expect any of the proposed changes to have a material impact on our business as we historically add clients in a competitive marketplace."
So lots of ticketing talk in Washington, but also lots of ticketing talk within the music industry. First, we should point out that the five-point plan from Live Nation has been backed by a number of other companies and organizations across the music community. That includes booking agencies CAA, WME, UTA and Wasserman Music, management firms Vector, Lafitte, Gelman and Redlight, and industry organizations like the Music Artists Coalition and Songwriters of North America. But last week, another campaign was launched, backed by some of the same companies and organisations, but also some other companies and organisations, including Ticketmaster rivals like C-Tickets and Dice. And perhaps most interestingly, as of yet, not Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which makes you wonder if this campaign, which is called Fix the Ticks, which, that's not a good name, might campaign on some of the issues Live Nation would prefer politicians to ignore, as well as very possibly some of the issues already included in Live Nation's five-point plan.
Now, so far, the organisers of Fix the Ticks haven't given too much information about what their priorities are. They said in a launch statement that Fix the Ticks was basically a broad coalition of live event industry organisations and professionals that have come together to collectively advocate for a ticketing experience better than the nightmare many fans and artists currently navigate. With representation from venues, promoters and producers, the performing arts, artist groups, recorded music and independent ticketing companies, this coalition represents stakeholders who take on all the risk to create once-in-a-lifetime experiences and bring joy, employment and economic impact to communities across America. We are coming together to protect fans from price gouging and deceptive and predatory ticketing practices. There will be more to come from our coalition very soon. So I guess with this particular campaign, it's a bit of a watch this space kind of thing going on. But I think it's certainly true that in the US at least, the big ticketing debate and all the different strands of that debate is set to rumble on for some time yet. But probably not on this edition of Setlist.
No, because that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go to the show notes, which you'll find in your podcast player, or at setlistpodcast.com. There will be links in there for you to read up more. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you haven't already, so you can get all future editions automatically. Rate and review the show if you enjoyed it. If you didn't, go for a walk. That's nice. And if you've got anything you want to tell us, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
Or, of course, if you're at the Great Escape, you could just come up to us in the main room where all the CMU sessions are happening. Say hello, give us any feedback. Or if you're at the Great Escape on Saturday morning, come and watch us record an issue. We'll have guests and everything. So if you are in Brighton this week, do come and say hello.
Yeah, but for now, let's just do this last bit. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.